From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Congratulations, by the way, to Matt and Allison Powers, new proud parents of daughter Alex. They're out there somewhere. Here's what's happening. Reversing a ban on oil drilling off most U.S. shores, President Barack Obama has announced an expansive new policy that could put oil and natural gas platforms in waters along the southern Atlantic coastline, the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and part of Alaska. The last hour of the program tonight, we'll be discussing this with expert Lindsay Williams about all of this. Jerry Corsi, though, on the line with us now. He's an expert in abiotic oil. Jerry, what do you think of this one?
Well, George, it's a start. It does not include any drilling off of California, Oregon, or Washington State, or in Alaska's Bristol Bay. That would have been more expansive. And also, if you take a close look at what Bill Burton, who is the assistant press secretary, announced after President Obama made the statement today, this is part of a attempt really to get Republicans to go along with a climate bill. In other words, I think the back door to cap and trade in a energy bill is what President Obama's after, and this is a trying to trade off with the Republicans, give the Republicans drilling to some extent that the Republicans want, and then to come back later for an energy bill which will include some form of climate cap and trade or other carbon limits.
And Jerry, you're going to be on with me on Easter Sunday talking about your new work, The Shroud Codex. I'm looking very favorable at this book right now, and I'm excited about this.
Well, George, I am too. It's my first novel. I'm really excited about it. I hope you like it, and I'm going to really look forward to being with you. I guess we're 3 hours. I'm looking. It'll be a great opportunity to really talk about the novel and The Shroud, and I guess Barry Schwartz will be joining us at the end of it, who Barry Schwartz's photographs. He was the official photographer from the 1978 Shroud of Turin research project. He'll be joining us for a while. And in my first novel, it's really an opportunity to look at the science, to debate the issues of faith. And I feel like it's a good read, more of a mystery story than a religious book. And I think it gives a really interesting opportunity to get deeply into the issues of whether the Shroud of Turin is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ, or a brilliant medieval forgery.
Well, you have a hearty Easter dinner, and then I'll see you Easter Sunday night.
I'm excited about it, George. I look forward to it. Thank you.
That's Jerome Corsi. A top Toyota executive says U.S. sales surged 40% in March, powered by some of its deepest discounts ever in the wake of millions of recalls. The Toyota Group vice president says that some of the incentives will continue past March, including an offer of free maintenance for return Toyota customers. Private employers unexpectedly shed more jobs in March, dimming hopes for job growth ahead of Friday's key employment report. Private employers cut 23,000 jobs in March, missing expectations for an increase in jobs, although fewer than the adjusted 24,000 jobs lost in February. This was a report by a private employment service. Texas town is on high alert now as a Mexican town across the border braces for cartel gun battles. At least 30 residents have gone across the border already into this small Texas town. Residents of a small Mexican border town under siege by at least one of the country's most notorious drug cartels are fleeing into this tiny Texas community, which is now on high alert and preparing for a surge of illegal immigrants should a street battle break out with another cartel, or if the gunmen begin carrying out a threat to start killing the town's children. At least 30 residents of this little town, located about 4 miles from the Texas border town of Fort Hancock, have crossed into the U.S. and have asked for political asylum, telling authorities that they fear for their lives. A tourist dies after falling into an active Bali volcano. The 25-year-old man from Sweden slipped as he tried to peer into the crater after a trek to the 5,600-foot summit on the northeastern side of the very popular Indonesian island. He fell 490 feet. Common toads appear to be able to sense an impending earthquake and will flee their colony days before the seismic activity strikes. The evidence comes from a population of toads, which left their breeding colony 3 days before an earthquake that struck in Italy in 2009. How the toads sensed the quake is unclear, but most breeding pairs and males were the ones to flee. Geologist Jim Berkland on the line with us here. Jim, you've known all along that animals can sense earthquakes coming.
Absolutely. The toad story, though, is relatively recent, but we certainly know what happened 2 years ago with the big quake in China. The pandas were all upset just before the 7.9 destroyed the town, and with thousands of school kids in poorly constructed buildings. And just before, one of the towns reported that there are hundreds of thousands of toads running around the streets. And the expert says, oh, don't pay attention to that. You know, no, it doesn't mean anything. Well, now we know about Italy, L'Aquila. The same sort of thing happened about 2 days before. Well, there were several peaks. It was supposed to be just the mating season, but a lot of the toads just disappeared at the time that they should have been really be happy. But so that was another one.
What is it, though? What is it about some of these animals? What do they have in their sensory system?
Well, it's very clear from what I've been running into. They all are sensitive to the electromagnetic field. We know that field changes prior to the significant earthquakes. It also changes right after a big solar storm. And that's why we have the aurora borealis in Australis. And we have magnetic effects on our radio equipment, and it becomes a hazard to the astronauts. It's very clear that there are different sources for these electromagnetic field changes, but to find the mechanism that animals can use is quite clear. We know they have this mineral magnetite in their bodies, Fe304. It has two different valence states of iron in a very dense, very resistant trace element that we find it in all, just about all rocks. And it's the black sand when you're planning for gold. And if you just go along the beach and see these little lines of black grains, put your magnet near there and it'll jump, the grains will jump up to the magnet. Well, anyway, they found in 1969 that iron bacteria had magnetite in them. And under a microscope, you have a magnet nearby, the little grains, little bacteria would all line up. Then they found magnetite behind homing pigeons' eyeballs. And then they found it in the dolphins, the dura, the brain case, the membrane around the brain case, with the largest grains of magnetite enclosed with a little nerve ending. So we know they didn't just accidentally get incorporated there. They're making use of it to orient themselves and travel thousands of miles, just like domestic animals can. With lost dogs and cats, they come home sometimes hundreds of miles.
Well, I got to tell you, Jim, they're great barometers, these animals. Maybe it's time for us to all get toads if we live in earthquake-stricken areas. Jim Berkland's website, SyzygyJob.com, will be part of our Twitter feed at CoastToCoastAM.com. Jim, thank you. An Israeli lawmaker is hoping to butter up voters and pass a law that would limit outrageous popcorn prices at the movies. Carmel Shama from the governing Likud party plans to bring the popcorn law for a vote when Parliament returns from its Passover break next week. A large box of popcorn usually sells for about $5 at theater concession stands, more than double what it costs at a supermarket, and 10 times more than what it would cost to make it at home. Up next, a Coast to Coast favorite joins us, Graham Hancock. His latest work, Entangled. You know him by his monumental work, Fingerprints of the Gods. Graham is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises very legitimate questions about humanity's history and prehistory and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars. He graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology. Then he went on to pursue a career in journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Graham, how are you?
Hi, George. Good to talk with you.
Looking forward to this. By the way, good work with Entangled.
And, thank you.
And this, if not your first novel, It's got to be one of your first, because
it is my first. It is my first novel. For the last 20 years, I've been writing these, you know, very large non-fiction books about historical mysteries. Fingerprints of the Gods, as you rightly said, is the best known. These have been very detailed works of research, where typically I've had a research library of more than 1,000 books for each book that I've written, and enormously detailed footnotes and annotations. And my non-fiction books stirred up a huge amount of controversy, and I started needing to bulletproof my arguments against the army of academic critics that would swarm out of the woodwork every time I published a book. And what I found, as I went on and on, by the time I got, for example, to Underworld in 2002, the book that reported on our diving expeditions looking for underwater ruins all around the world, was that I was producing books that were like 800 pages long. And they were 800 pages long because I had to bulletproof the arguments against the attacks of critics. And suddenly I thought, what a liberation it would be to express the extraordinary ideas that I'm interested in, but instead of expressing them in a factual book, which, you know, brings this mass of hostility out of the woodwork, why not slip those ideas into a fantastic, fast-moving, action-paced fantasy adventure story? Particularly when the ideas are so strange that maybe no you know, so-called factual presentation of them is possible. And I suddenly realized this is incredibly liberating for me. I can write whatever I like, and if the if the academic police come pouring out of the woodwork and accuse me of misrepresenting the facts or whatever spin they want to put on it, I can just say, hey guys, relax, it's just fantasy.
Well, this one is an extraordinary story, and did you was this based on lifetime experience?
Yes. I wrote a non-fiction book called Supernatural, which looks at the origins of religion and spiritual experience in shamanistic altered states of consciousness. And while I was researching that book, because I always throw myself into the subject I'm investigating, I had to go to the Amazon and drink this powerful visionary brew that shamans use there called ayahuasca, which sends you into an absolutely seamlessly convincing parallel world and puts you into telepathic contact with extraordinary entities, often in the form of a serpent. And actually, I've now drunk ayahuasca in the Amazon more than 30 times. And it was during a series of ayahuasca sessions in Brazil. I had already changed my intent. I was already interested in the idea of writing fiction. And I asked ayahuasca, and this is what you do with ayahuasca sessions. You ask the spirit of ayahuasca to help you in a particular area of your intent. And my intent was to write a really exciting but also deep work of fiction. And that night, ayahuasca gave me an extraordinary series of visions in which I saw the two central characters of my novel, one of them a young woman in the Stone Age 24,000 years ago, and one of them a young woman today in modern Los Angeles. And because time is not what it seems, because actually all times coexist simultaneously, and the illusion of past, present, and future is exactly that, an illusion. It's possible for these two young women to become entangled, and a supernatural being indeed entangles them and conscripts them into a battle of good against evil, a battle with a demonic force which is operating both 24,000 years ago in the Stone Age and today in the 21st century. And I was just given this whole concept with incredible vividness and power during this series of visions in the Amazon. And not only that, but I was given a very strong instruction: write this and write it now.
and you did.
That vision, that's what I've been doing.
I've got to tell you about synchronicity here, Graham. Sunday night, I was renting the DVD 2012, Roland Emmerich's blockbuster. So I'm at home watching it, and all of a sudden, up pops really a hat tip to you in the book Fingerprints of the Gods. Tell me about that.
Well, it's, you know, strange. I've discovered that there are actually more lawyers than creative people in Hollywood.
And tell me about
and because of the giant tribe of Hollywood lawyers, I'm not actually allowed to say anything about this, but I am glad to say that the credits of the film do say, inspired in part by the book Fingerprints of the Gods, Graham Hancock, and I'm grateful to Roland for being kind enough to give me that credit. I guess what happens is that Fingerprints of the Gods is the first book that puts together the possibly dire prophecies of the Mayan calendar with the notion of Earth crust displacement, which was brought into public knowledge by Professor Charles Hapgood back in the 1960s. Fingerprints, being very much a work of synthesis, brought these two ideas for the first kind, and I can see that those two ideas are also quite central to the movie 2012.
Well, I hope you got full credit for what you, whatever you did.
I'm grateful to them for giving me a credit on the credits of the movie. It was a buzz, you know, to sit there and actually see my name on the big screen. Finally made it to Hollywood. Way.
Well, yeah, look, you deserve it. You've been on this program for years, Graham, and you're one of the best guests we have. And the book Fingerprints of the Gods, of course, has this core message that I'd like to take some time this hour just to talk about before we get into Entangled.
Yeah.
Tell us the message you're trying to give with Fingerprints of the Gods.
Well, it comes down to this. We are presented with a story of our past by academic historians and the mainstream media. And I would say, I believe that story of our past that we're taught in our schools and through the medias and in our universities, that story of our past is part of the mind control that operates in our society today. In order to control billions of people around the world, you also need to be able to control their past. True knowledge of the past can be incredibly liberating. And if you don't want a liberated population, then you want to force feed them a particular edited version of the past. And I believe that it's that particular edited version of the past that we are being given through the mainstream in modern society today. And I've made it my business for many years to provide a reasoned, well-supported, logical, and thorough alternative voice to that point of view, to say that, yes, the picture of history may be as the academic historians tell us it is, but it may not be that way at all. It could also be very, very, very different. Here are a set of facts that the academics have interpreted one way. Here's another way to interpret those facts, which completely changes our view of history. And, you know, as you go further and further back into the past, as you get back particularly beyond 5,000 years ago, you find yourself in a period of darkness where there are no documents, no records, nothing, just flimsy, fragmentary evidence that archaeologists can dig up when they typically excavate 1 or 2% of a large site. And from this flimsy evidence, they then put together their interpretation of what the past is. And to my mind, that interpretation is not a whole lot better than a fairy story. So when we have a fairy story being presented to us as fact, I think it's important to say, well, hang on, these facts may not be quite the way they're being told to us. And so that's what I tried to do. And the bottom line is, I think there's been a huge forgotten episode in human history. I think all the myths and traditions of a great lost civilization destroyed in a huge global cataclysm, leaving only a very few survivors. I think that tradition is absolutely true. I think it's the only memory we have as a species of a time before we lost our memory, a time when something so horrendous happened to the Earth and happened to humanity that our memory banks were virtually completely wiped, leaving us only with the myths and traditions. So I've tried to show that actually you can go beyond the myths and traditions, and that you can present really quite solid and disturbing evidence which suggests that we have to reconsider the picture of our past. And I'd go further than that and say, as individuals, as free individuals, as adults, we owe it to ourselves to take possession of our past. It belongs to us. It does not belong to the specialists and to the experts.
There's no question about that, Graham. We're going to take this quick break, then we're going to come right back with you. Let's talk about this cataclysm and what happened to civilization. We'll be back. Sure is, with our special guest tonight, Graham Hancock, as we talk about his work in Tangled and also Fingerprints of the Gods. And when we come right back with Graham, let's find out what this catastrophe was that might have hit this lost civilization a very long time ago. We'll be right back. And we're back with Graham Hancock. Graham, when did this lost civilization simply vanish off the face of the planet? How long ago?
By the way, George, can I just mention, because there's a huge amount of additional information on all of this on my website, which
sure.
I'd like to refer people to. That's www.grahamhancock.com, as simple as that.
Excellent. And we've got a link for you at Coast.
You've got a link up on the site, which I'm very, very grateful for. When did the cataclysm occur?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I tie this whole mystery in to really an issue that should concern us a lot today with talk of climate change. And this is the end of the last ice age. It's a period that I feel has been, indeed the whole of the ice age, which lasted from about 125,000 years ago down to about 12,000 years ago, is a very, very mysterious period, which is not fully explained. The only thing that's certain is that gigantic cataclysmic events took place all over the Earth during this period. For anybody born between 125,000 years ago and, say, about 13,000 years ago, they would have experienced a world that looked very different from our world today, which was covered in gigantic ice sheets, North America, well to the south of New York, the whole of Northern Europe, covered in these huge ice sheets that were actually between, more than 2 miles thick, 2 to 3 miles thick.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the colossal weight of those ice sheets pressing down on the continental landmass underneath them? When that happens, you get the land pushed down into the crust of the Earth. And when the ice begins to melt, the land that's been pressed down underneath it begins to bounce back. That's called isostasy. So it's not surprising that geologists have discovered evidence that while these huge ice sheets were melting, sometimes incredibly rapidly, there was also extraordinary seismic activity, earthquakes and volcanic eruptions taking place all over the world and filling our skies with clouds of thick dust and smoke and cutting off the light of the sun, making the whole situation much worse. So we're looking at a long period of sustained cataclysm with episodes of really, truly gigantic cataclysms taking place. And those episodes were when thousands of years of meltwater that had accumulated on top of the ice caps burst out of their ice dams and poured down the ice sheet, reaching fantastic speeds. Sometimes you would have waves that have been estimated to be as much as 600 feet high pouring down off the ice sheet. You imagine a mountain 2 miles high with a wave of water 600 feet high.
Oh my.
Pouring off the top of it and surging down the sides of that mountain and coming onto the flat land below, tearing across that land, reaming it out, destroying everything in its path. When we look at the remnants of this, we can look, for example, at the Finger Lakes of New York State. You know, they are caused, the Scablands of New Jersey, they're caused by these incredible outflow floods. And then that mass of water smashes into the world ocean. And at times, there were at least 3 episodes during the period of the meltdown where you had effectively a 30-foot rise in sea level taking place pretty much overnight. And of course, you can only imagine what an overnight 30-foot rise in sea level would do to our civilization today. I believe it would bring us down, actually, when you consider how many of our great cities are on the coasts.
the shorelines would go in hundreds of miles.
Hundreds of miles, yes, yes, hundreds of miles, and that's indeed what happened at the end of the last ice age. The face of the Earth changed. Those ice sheets came off the continents. Sea levels rose dramatically. Millions of square miles of land. It's been estimated to be the equivalent of the whole of Europe and the whole of China added together in terms of land area were swallowed by the sea, and now lie as much as 400 feet beneath sea level. And to my mind, this extraordinary period of dreadful climatic instability culminating in a series of really gigantic cataclysms, it's very, very tempting to link that together with the traditions of mist, of floods that come down to us, with stories of a golden age, of a time when the gods walked the earth, and how a great cataclysm came and destroyed it all, leaving only a few survivors and a few memories of what went before. Plato put it better than anybody in the story of Atlantis when he talked about the dreadful floods and earthquakes that submerged Atlantis in a single terrible day and a night. And he said that after that, we had to begin again like children, with no memory of what went before. And to me, that's a very profound and telling remark. And there is one other thing, and this is relatively new evidence come out within the last 2 or 3 years, and it's being refined. There's been some challenges from the academic community, but the evidence itself comes from leading academics. And this is of a gigantic cometary impact, which actually hit North America roughly around 10,900 BC. In other words, 12,900 years ago, exactly in that window that I've been talking about of these cataclysmic changes. A huge comet exploded in the atmosphere, broke into multiple pieces, smashed all over North America, created features like the Carolina Bays, caused a mass extinction in North America, sent clouds of debris and dust up into the atmosphere, created a global winter for about 800 or 900 years, plunged the Earth back deeply into ice age conditions, and then emerged from it. So that was really the final cataclysm at the end of the ice age. And it's exactly that time, around 12,900 years ago, give or take 400 or 500 years. You know, this is not an exact science when we're dealing with such distances of time. It's exactly that period that all the evidence from myth and tradition and from strange and mysterious monuments around the world points to a disaster that wiped out a great civilization, leaving only a few traces.
Did these people see anything coming, Graham, or were they just gone like that?
I think that the way I look at it, I don't think they saw it coming.
No.
I think there were survivors who worked it out afterwards. And I think they tried very hard to recreate civilization or to create the basis for the emergence of future civilizations. And into everything that they did, I think they encoded a warning. They encoded information about what had happened to them, and they passed down to us the notion that it could happen again. And you know, weirdly, when we get into all of these traditions and myths concerning the destruction of a great civilization of prehistory and concerning the loss of a golden age, we always find that humanity is in some very direct way implicated in the story. That when the story is told, it isn't just a story of random geological and climatic events. It's a story that mankind has fallen out of balance or out of harmony with the universe or with the will of the gods, that we've been given this incredible gift, this planet, this life as human beings, and that we've somehow squandered it and wasted it and made the gods angry with us. This is again and again the message that comes through in the myths and traditions of flood from around the world. And you know, I have to say, if I look at our civilization purely in mythological terms, then you know, I would say that we look very like the next lost civilization, unless we learn the message from the past. unless we listen to it, unless we change.
I was going to ask you, have we picked up anything from the message from the past?
Well, I think that at the level of the general public, more and more this is happening. People are no longer buying the story that is told to us by the mainstream, and are more and more willing to listen to these extraordinary messages that come down to us from the past. But at the level of the mainstream, no, I don't think that there's been any attempt to do it at all. Rather, academic historians have felt so annoyed by the suggestion that they might be wrong that they have gathered round and gathered their friends in the media and done everything that they can to shoot down this idea and to shoot down those who've come bearing this message, and just to pretend that it's just not there, that there is nothing, there is no case to answer, that there is nothing to say. But I do think at the level of the general public, and more so, we are waking up. We're all growing tired of the existing paradigm, of the existing idea of how we should live and of how we lived in the past. We're tired of government manipulation. We're tired of being fed lies and spin. We realize that more and more that a large and important part of our story is missing, and that part of that concerns the past. So there's this active area of inquiry and a feeling that whatever we're told, we have to take our destinies into our own hands.
Graham, when we look at the past and then we look forward into the future, we see the Mayan calendar end date of December 21st, 2012, of which some people are predicting the end of the world. They're predicting doom and gloom. Others predict an awakening of consciousness. I have said I think there's going to be some kind of solar event, though not to the point where it's going to wipe out civilization as we know it, but it could do something. What do you think? What's your take?
I think that we've come to a very important place marker. And what actually happens next, what happens with this time, which is recognized that we're coming to this 21st of December, the winter solstice 2012, which is increasingly recognized all around the world as a sacred and special moment, and possibly as a moment of jeopardy, but possibly almost also as a moment of great hope. I think that what happens is much more up to us than we realize, that we're not simply the victims of blind forces. I think if we look around the planet today, it's possible to see as never before in recorded history, two things are happening. One is a rebirth of consciousness on a gigantic scale, and that results from the incredible facility of the internet. A rebirth of consciousness, an awakening of goodwill, a welling up of love throughout the planet. And on the other side, dark as hell, is what the powers that be are doing to us in our world today. The dreadful destruction, the wars, the manipulation of populations, the artificial separation of people into religious groups and clubs, where if you're not a member of our club, we're going to kill you. This kind of brainwashing, this kind of thinking, the hatred that is also present in the world, the huge commitment to material processes, ignoring completely the spiritual side of man. All of this is very worrying and very dark and very concerning. And indeed, the more we allow that trend to continue, the more certain it will become that we will plunge ourselves into a disaster. And yet on the other side of it, there's this hope. There's this upwelling of love and decency and goodness. There's a sharing of novel and interesting ideas. There's a really goodwill, a manifestation of goodwill for the future. So I see us poised at a crossroads, really a kind of battle of good against evil, in which the choices that we make right now, right here in our lives, in front of our faces, we can't change the world, you and I, George, and everybody listening. As individuals, we can't change the world. But what we can do is change how we function in our own lives. We can become more nurturing, more caring. We can do everything possible to give more love, to be less toxic, to be less cruel, to be a positive force in our immediate environment. And I think that I think that if that's done across the scale of billions of people, then this dead hand of orthodox materialism that is pressing us down and forcing us into needless conflicts, these evil angels who are mingling with us, will no longer have their power.
I think you're right. I think we have free will. I think we can control our own destiny. And I think if you look at past civilizations and understand what happened to them, what they went through, we might be able to fix some things. Though it's going to be a battleground, because it's a world between the haves and the have-nots, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's a huge battle underway and ahead, and when we talk of the haves and the have-nots, I think I'd like to put a different angle on that.
All right.
Because the haves are a very small number of people who have real knowledge about what's going on and who pull the levers of power and who control the money and who are the real feudal aristocrats of modern industrial society. They're the haves. And the have-nots, that's all the rest of us who are bewildered and blinded by, you know, 50 years of propaganda and ideology and false information that's been put out to us through the media about who we are and what we are and why we're here and about the nature of reality. So if we want to be, if we want to recognize and realize our birthrights as human beings, we have to take control of the information about ourselves.
Absolutely. I want to spend all of next hour talking about Entangled and how this ties into many of the things that we've been talking about this hour, Graham. And I also congratulate you on your work that you've been doing over the years. You've had an incredible perception, and I think a lot of that stems from what we'll talk about in a few minutes, and that's human consciousness. You have tapped into something.
Thank you, George. Thank you. I'm just so aware of the power of mind control in our societies, and what I've tried to do is to be a voice that provides alternative information and hopefully make some contribution in that way. But the forces that we are up against are just so huge that I must say sometimes I despair.
Oh, it is tough. And it's a bombardment that is occurring every day.
Yes.
Why doesn't science jump on the bandwagon of stories like Fingerprints of the Gods and say, okay, we think he's right. A lost civilization was here and it's gone.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't even mind if they didn't say we think he's right. I just wish that they would say we think this is worth looking at, you know, rather than just closing our eyes completely to the majestic mystery of our past as a species. I don't know. I think that there's a series of prejudices and ideas within science that make it impossible to grasp such ideas, just as they make it very difficult for science to grasp ideas concerning the paranormal. You know, there's a deeply rooted materialistic culture in science. Everything must be weighable, measurable, and countable. If it isn't weighable, measurable, and countable, and for example, you can't weigh, measure, or count a myth, if it isn't weighable, measurable, and countable, then science ignores it completely. And that kind of very much limits the evidence field with which science is willing to operate, unfortunately, and rules out all kinds of intriguing inquiries. You know, scientists will say that there is no such thing as the soul. We are only bodies. You know, and they say there's actually no point in even investigating. Could it be that we have a soul? As though they're in the command of tremendous facts about this information, but actually science has no facts on this subject at all, just prejudice, which is presented in a very convincing manner by Dr. X or Professor Y, and unfortunately accepted by large numbers of members of the public.
Though you do have your supporters out there, don't you?
Yes, and I'm very grateful to them. I mean, really, it's if I've done anything, it's partly, largely, I would say, been because of my readers, because I have people out there who really care about this stuff, and you know, I'm lucky. I'm in the fortunate position to be able to spend my time researching and gathering this data, and putting it together. But then I'm putting it at the disposal, the way I see it. I'm putting it at the disposal of millions of intelligent questioning people who can then use that data and integrate it into what they know and challenge the existing framework.
Absolutely. Next hour, we'll talk about Graham's new work, Entangled, on Coast to Coast AM.